Sorry to disturb you at this hour, but I have something you want.
A new TV?
It broadcast programs no one had ever seen.
Wednesday at 9, don't miss an all-new episode of The Silencer of the Lambs.
Then one night, Roy and Helen Nabel got sucked in and discovered that hell is one TV show after another.
Let's welcome our new contestants, Roy and Helen Nabel.
And they're starring in every show.
I've watched enough wrestling to know one thing. It's all fake. No one ever gets...
So the object
the object, Mr. Pierce, is to kill them before they reach the end.
Oh, my God. We're cartoons.
I am not a mouse. I'm Helen Nabel. I have two beautiful children.
Mom? Our parents are trapped in television.
Now, they can't go home. They can only switch channels.
Where did he go?
Hey, lady, watch out!
And every series is a nightmare.
That's entertainment.
Because Satan is the sponsor.
Okay, everybody, head spins. Very good, very nice.
Well, time to rock and roll.
Star me up. You got to star me up. Star me up.
Don't miss this comedy from hell. Stay tuned.
Where have you been?
Welcome to They Call This a Movie, testing the strength of friendships one terrible movie at a time. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and other podcast services by searching They Call This a Movie. We are part of the Main Namey Network. To find more from us, check out the website, themainnamey.com, or on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, at themainnamey. We are also now a proud member of Geek Fives Nation. You can find them at gbnation.com. Welcome back to They Call This a Movie. This is Anthony Delvecchio. With me, as always, is Dan Aquino and Mark Meyer. Say hello, gentlemen.
Hey, how's it going, everybody?
Why was this TV yellow in this movie? It's been something I've been thinking about.
Wait, the magic TV?
Yeah.
It's because it's from
it
hell.
It was the 90s.
I mean, I would...
It's a TV from a hell. What's the last what's the last color you'd want red. It to be? It's yellow.
Red?
I'd have a red TV. I'd have a red TV before I have a yellow TV.
That's true.
So you're more concerned about the color of the TV and not the gigantic satellite that they were somehow able to fit in a minivan?
It's the 90s. That's what satellite dishes look like.
That thing took up... That was as big as a house.
Well, yeah, that's how you get good reception.
Now, well, of course. But now, think about it. That only works if they have a big enough backyard.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Yeah. So the devil's flaw is plan... Or the devil's plan is flawed.
Spike ain't going to the urban areas.
Right. Right. So he only preys on suburban deadbeats, I guess?
And I guess houses that have a lot of space facing south.
Yeah, it's weird.
I don't know if that's a thing with satellites. It just seems...
Yeah, that is true. All satellites face south. I honestly don't know if that's true or not.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's other departments in hell that take care of the people that don't have enough space for a giant satellite dish.
So it's classist.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, yeah. Yeah.
Well, we figured out the problem with this movie right off the get-go.
You're welcome.
Cancel this movie. You can't make this movie today.
You couldn't. No, you couldn't. It's terrible.
As soon as that satellite dish gets put down, somebody would be like, what the fuck is that?
But at the end, there is a person of color in charge of hell, so.
True.
That is pretty... The hell network, yeah. So that is very progressive.
I think it's technically hell vision.
Is that what they call? I couldn't.
Just television in general.
They had like two. I thought they had like two or three different brand names, so I couldn't quite pinpoint what the name of the network was entirely.
I mean, there were 666 channels within 900 lines of resolution. So.
Yeah, I was really bummed out because, you know, like Married with Children. I liked Married with Children growing up, and I was hoping that that would be one of the gags. Yeah. And I was hoping the gag would just be Married with Children, you know, because that is hell.
Yeah.
But no, they went with the Unmarried with Children. I was like, well, that's not really, you know, I get it, but yeah. It's not as it didn't hit.
Yeah, it's one of those gags that they just didn't have time for and they wanted to get it in at the end. But before we fully get into this week's movie, gentlemen, what have you watched this week?
I watched a couple documentaries. We watched The Last Blockbuster,
okay,
which was really good. I enjoyed that. And I watched The Power of Grayskull, the He-Man documentary.
Okay.
And I also watched a Matthew Broderick movie called Election.
It's because we told him to go fuck himself last week, right?
Yes, that's why. That's like subconsciously, that's why I picked that movie.
Well, you did watch all those Dane Cook movies for no reason one time.
Well, that was for...
no reason, quote unquote. Yeah.
Right. Well, I was laying in bed and this movie, it called to me for whatever reason. And then there was actually something kind of interesting in this movie. Do you guys remember Chris Klein?
Yep.
Remember that guy? He was a thing.
Yeah, for some reason.
Yeah, and you know, he played like the jock, the dumb jock in it, but he was like super sweet in it. And I wondered what happened to Chris Klein, right? Because I feel like he was the RC Cola of Josh Hartnett's.
I think the same thing happened to Chris Klein as did every member of the American Pie cast. What happened to Tara Reid? What happened to Mina Suvari? What happened to Sean William Scott? What happened to Jason Biggs? It's just, we turned a page into a new century and we left them behind.
Sean William Scott still got some work in the later 2000s, at least.
Yeah, his clock ran out around 2009.
That's fair. Right, Cop Out was kind of... eh.
Yeah. And then Jason Biggs, he hitched his wagon to the Orange is the New Black star and pissed everybody off for like 3 seasons because he was horrible in it.
He was a victim of his own Twitter.
Oh, right? Yeah. People hated that he like would live tweet The Bachelor or something like
something
that.
Imagine that. That's what you get. That's what you get axed for. Like all the stupid shit you say, and then it's like you ruin The Bachelor. That's how they get you. But that is very on par for America.
Yeah. You watch anything else?
I believe. No, I think that was it.
Okay. What about you, Mark?
I actually watched something this week.
Well, wonders never cease.
Yeah. No surprise to you. It was In the Heights, the Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Oh, wow. Did you go to the theaters to see this?
No, HBO Max.
Oh, HBO Max. Okay.
But wait, why did you say no surprise to us? Because it seemed like Anthony was surprised.
I was surprised.
And I'm surprised.
I didn't realize it was on HBO Max. That was my surprise.
He was surprised that I went to a theater to see it. So my one main review of it, it's great. I 2.5 hours flew by. It was ridiculous. Just like Hamilton's 3 hours went by. Is that you can really tell that this was Lin-Manuel Miranda's first try at writing a musical. Because there's like moments where it doesn't flow as well as Hamilton, you know, or even as well as and some of the songs aren't as good as even the stuff in Moana and things like that. But the story itself, you could tell how personal some of it was because they had to update some of the stories because it was written in he started writing it in 1999 and it came out in 2008. So a lot of things have happened in the Latinx community since that moment. You know, the Dreamers, DACA, all that stuff, and the things that happened over the last few years. So they had to include all that stuff in it to upgrade it. So some of that stuff felt a little stilted because it wasn't in the original music. But what's his name? Anthony Ramos, who plays Lin-Manuel Miranda's role as Unavi, is really good. He's the right actor to sort of give it. If this movie would have came out last year, I think it would have gotten a lot more opening weekend just because it would have hit right around the time Hamilton was coming out on Disney Plus, you know, because it was scheduled in the same time period. It's just a fun movie, mixing all the types of different Latin music together. And they do a one big thing where each country's sort of flavor of that music is sort of mashed together into a scene. If you don't like musicals, you're probably not going to like it. It's one of those where most of the dialogue is music. And then there's also a brief moment where Jimmy Smith sings. So if you really like, let's just say, better than Russell Crowe. Okay. The way he sang in the movie, he sounds fine, but compared to everyone else around him, they're ridiculously good. But the parts where he was not singing, the acting. But yeah, I recommend it. I don't know if it would have been better in theaters, in a full theater, you know, without COVID. But it's definitely worth the watch, and doesn't feel as long as the length would make it seem before you start the movie.
Okay. Yeah. And as for me, I watched a new movie, too. We watched Cruella, the Disney live-action version of 101 Dalmatians. I gotta say, it might be the best Disney live-action movie they've done so far. It's a lot of fun. It's not great. I mean, if you want to sit here and say, well, was there even a reason to have this kind of origin story? Probably not. But you know what? Emma Stone's really good in it. She's really fun in it. She chews the scenery like a motherfucker. Emma Thompson's really good in it as the antagonist. There is a weird, just so much needle drops and like pop music, which is a little weird. But I enjoyed myself with it. I gotta be honest. Good. Yeah, I was surprised.
I'm waiting for that to come free on Disney Plus.
Yeah, the wife sprung for the premiere access. So
I heard, maybe I shouldn't give it away, but the reason as to why Cruella, you know, becomes, she's a very famous, I would say she's a very famous Disney villain, right?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously to get her own movie, but obviously her big thing is she kills animals for outerwear. So the reason why I found it to be a tad ridiculous, is it as ridiculous as I've heard?
It seems kind of like happenstance. It's not so much, it's a little forced in terms of getting the Dalmatians in there, and it feels more like just an Easter egg of it. Like, it's really more about Emma Thompson's role in the whole situation more than it is the Dalmatians. I'll say that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I do want to see that movie because I've heard very good things.
Yeah.
And the Disney live action movies are terrible. I've hated pretty much all of them.
I would say Jungle Book was probably the most solid besides this one.
Yeah. It was kind of boring.
But I don't have any allegiance to the original one either. So
sure.
I don't really remember the original one. Yeah, but the other ones have been pretty bad. Cinderella was okay, but forgettable. Yeah.
I don't think Cinderella needed to. None of these need to be retold,
by the way.
But, there, you know.
If you're holding on to the rights to it, then it does, though. Well, that's capitalism, baby.
Do they ever lose the rights?
Eventually, yes,
really?
Technically.
Oh,
it's like, I think Disney has ruined copyright laws.
Yeah, they took
world.
Over.
I think they figured out that they still hold the rights to them, but I'm pretty sure that's the reason. And they've figured out that it's something to do with also how close they are to the original scripts from the animated versions, that if they don't have to repay anybody to write a script, so they save money that way. It's all money, baby.
Oh, that's what I heard about that. Like the writers of the original Aladdin were super pissed.
Yeah.
So it's because they changed it just enough, right, where they didn't need to really pay them.
Yeah. So people in the audience might say, do we really need this? And the answer for the audience is no. But audience, a little secret, it don't matter what you want or what you don't want. It's what's going to make people money. That's capitalism.
Yes. Yep. And it always makes money.
Yeah, exactly. They're going to send it over to China if they don't make their money here. If they don't make their nut here, send it to China and they'll make their nut there. That's why Mulan probably still made bank too.
It cracks me up because you'll hear, you know, people like us will bitch and moan about like, oh, these don't need to be remade. And we're not the only ones. But again, these movies will just kill at the box office. And, you know, I feel like a lot of people who do say this doesn't need to be remade still go and see it.
Yeah, this is one thing too, and I was thinking about this because I was thinking about it after I had watched it. I feel like this conversation really only gets a full head of steam in female-centric movies, because it's this and another movie that got this kind of ire was Little Women when it came out in 2019.
Interesting.
Another adaptation of Little Women. And then on the flip side, how many versions of Batman do we get?
I hope the next version we get is him going down on somebody. That'd be great.
And we got it for all of a week when Joker came out, and then everybody wound up loving it. Gave it a fucking Oscar nominations and wins.
Well, he won.
Everybody forgot about it.
Yeah.
Do we need a new Joker movie?
No.
We did not. But nobody says that anymore.
Also, one of the parallels, because I think you're right. I do think it's probably, and it may be no one has data on it, but you're probably right, knowing how our society is.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't want to delve into that. That's not what we're here for.
Nope.
But I was also curious because, you know, a new Guardians of the Galaxy movie is coming out. Mm-hmm. And you got a lot of people who don't like Chris Pratt now, yeah. Right? That movie's going to make fucking bank. You mm-hmm. know it's going to make bank. And I wonder if those people who are on Twitter saying, oh, well, you know, Chris Pratt's not a good dude, blah, 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 whatever, secretly go to see these movies regardless, yeah. You know? There's got to be a bunch of them.
Sure. And at the very least, it's probably a loud minority, really. It's a loud minority of people on Twitter being like, all right, Chris Pratt hasn't disavowed his church, blah, blah, blah. As opposed to the 400 million people in the United States, right?
300, something like that, yeah.
I think we're like 400 million of the people that are going to watch that movie, yeah. Basically.
We might be slightly under that now after the last year.
Ouch. That's dark. Ouch.
It made me wonder because, you know, a lot of people will talk a big game. And then, but it's like, oh, but, you know, Baby Groot or... I like so-and-so, so I'm not going to let that bother me. You know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. a lot of people feign social justice, I guess.
Yeah, I think there is some posturing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good word, posturing. There's a lot of posturing. But yeah, I didn't mean for it to get serious here. Well, but I was just curious.
Hopefully we don't get canceled for this. But I think that's all we watched this week. So we're going to take a quick break. We're going to listen to some ads so we can pay those bills, and we'll be right back. And welcome back. Now it's time to get into this week's movie. And this week was my pick. And I picked a little movie that I had seen probably a half dozen times in my life before this. It was a staple on HBO when I was a kid. So I picked Stay Tuned, the 1992 film starring the late, great John Ritter. Gentlemen, where are you coming from with Stay Tuned?
I had never seen this movie. I never even heard of this movie. Didn't know it existed until a couple days ago. But it was silly. It was definitely 90s. This movie screamed 90s. Holy shit. But I liked it. I thought it was pretty cool. It's an interesting concept.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me of like a really cheesy B horror movie. I think with like Terrorvision,
yep.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of that. Obviously, it's different genres, but I like the cast in this movie. Yeah, John Ritter was really good. Pam Dwarber, I think her name is.
Dauber.
She's Mindy, right? From Mork and Mindy.
Yep.
Yeah, she was good in this. She was a babe in this. She looked great.
Yeah.
And she was definitely out of John Ritter's league in this movie. Yeah, I thought this was a lot of fun. And again, I it wasn't great, but it was very silly. And it's a good cheesy movie.
Sure. Mark, what about you?
Yeah. I had also never seen it before, but I was aware of it. Probably from walking around Blockbuster more than anything. But I've never seen it. I agree 100% with Dan. The movie feels very 90s, down to the fact that he's wearing a Seattle Supersonics hat. despite the fact that I don't even know if they say it's set in Seattle. Like, it's such an odd choice for the night. Like, you know, we can't do Bulls.
He does mention that they're from Seattle, Washington, okay. When he's about to get his head chopped off.
Oh, okay. Then that makes more sense. I just thought it was one of those things where Bulls would be too obvious. You know, what other cool 90s team can we give them? I had fun watching it. You know, John Ritter is pretty good at making you want to watch him when he's on screen. Like one of those things where it's like, all right, this is either something silly is going to happen or... you know, a good joke's going to come or something. But I think the one thing that probably hit me while watching this today is there were a lot of maybe jokes and references and things they said that I just didn't get. a lot of the major stuff I got, obvious. But, you know, the French Revolution thing and all that stuff, maybe I just didn't have in my head 90s television at that moment that wasn't anything, you know, short of sitcoms and stuff like that, being only 7-8 years old around the time this movie was coming out. But, yeah, overall, a lot better than I thought going in. I thought it was going to be one of these things that would have been of its time in that it didn't age well. But they stayed away from a lot of that stuff, it seemed like.
Sure. Yeah, I find this movie super charming. It's darker than, I don't know, there's some dark comedy moments in this movie with one of my favorite jokes in this movie is Different Strokes.
Yes.
That's one of the jokes that hits so well for me. And it's just, this movie's PG. And I think one of the problems with this movie is that it played to an audience that probably didn't really exist, because it's PG, it's very family, it's a family friendly movie in essence, but it's also some dark humor that are gonna go right over the kids' heads. I loved this movie when I was a kid, and to be honest with you, it holds up. John Ritter is so dorky charismatic in this movie. Like, towards the end of it, when the very last scene, there was a flash of him that just, like, when he's teaching at the fencing school, there's a flash of him, and then it was just like, it clicked for me. I was like, oh, that's why he was picked to be Zach Braff's dad in Scrubs.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he's a salesman too.
It's like that moment was like, there was just a smile or a smirk, and like, oh, I totally get it. There it is. But yeah, there was one thing I saw in the trivia that they approached Mike Myers and Dana Carvey to do cameos in it for the Dwayne and Garf, and they couldn't do it because they were actually filming the actual movie, Wayne's World, the first one. And I was just thinking, man, that would have been such a great moment in this movie if that was those two guys. That's also a fun scene too. That scene makes me laugh. But there is, the one moment that makes this movie to me is the Three's Company.
Yeah.
The Three's Company joke. It's so perfect, and they hold on to it until like the last 15 minutes of this movie.
Yep.
But it's just so obvious, and it's so great when it's such a rewarding joke when it finally comes across. And yeah, I love this movie. This movie totally held up for me.
It's a lot of fun for sure.
Yeah. It was this movie played, so there's like three movies that like used to play on HBO all the time, and I've probably seen them each half dozen times. It's this movie, it's another Jeffrey Jones movie, Mom and Dad Save the World, or Save the Universe, whatever it's called, Mom and Dad Save the World, and Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. Three movies from around the same era, and they're just like on HBO because HBO didn't really have anything to fill their schedule with back then. So this is one of those movies that I've seen a whole bunch of times.
Yeah, great. I think the PG rating helps with having it not be problematic.
Mm-hmm. You know? But they curse too in this.
I meant like making like references or things that wouldn't play in 2021.
Sure, but I was surprised because I figured it was PG-13 because Pam Dauber calls Mrs. Gorgon in the wrestling match a bitch twice. My three sons of bitches.
That's right.
Someone calls somebody a bastard. Perfect 90s cursing in that still gets a PG rating.
And this is another movie that we covered with a very weird hip-hop cameo.
Yeah.
Salt and Pepper.
And it's a full-on cameo. Yeah. That's a full song.
I would have loved to have known the approach to them in this.
Yeah, I that's what I'm saying. Like Tupac being in, what was the name of that movie?
Nothing But Trouble.
Nothing But Trouble. Like Tupac being in that, very out of place, way more out of place than here. Because at least they had the whole MTV gag, HTV.
Yeah.
HTV. Right? So I get that. But at the same time, were they one of the biggest draws, or was that the biggest draw they could get? And I was 92. Also,
I think this is their heyday, right?
I would imagine, right? And they were big in the early 90s. And also, there was a part of me that was hoping, because you know they have the gag. John Ritter looks hilarious in his getup, and I was hoping, I was like, this would be hilarious if he just fucking busted out dancing with the backup dancers and he just knew how to dance. But, you know, they did the whole shtick. He's, you know, fish out of water.
Mm-hmm.
But then at the end, he does like a little bit of a, he breaks it down a little bit. It's like, okay. Yeah. So they saved it there. I thought that was funny. But yeah, it was an interesting, I feel like this movie definitely took advantage of being in a television universe.
Definitely. Right?
Yeah, you get the cartoon universe. You get the black and white. You get a whole spectrum. And I liked it. Like, they didn't just stick to maybe one or two genres, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You start out with the game network. And, yeah, they built upon it. They didn't just cheap out.
Yeah. What was your favorite parody?
Oh, my favorite parody. I didn't love the Wayne's World one as much. I thought that was okay, but then I felt like it maybe went on a little too long.
Okay.
Man, my favorite parody.
If that was Mike Myers and Dana Carvey,
it would have been so much better, easily so much better. But I thought for a second that was Dana Carvey. It sounded just like him, so I had to look it up. I thought the cartoon world was pretty good. Because I like how they had all the tropes where the, you know, the house burns down, but he can't get out of the mouse door.
Yeah.
And how he solves it is he writes away to like Acme and he gets a robot dog to fight the robot cat. So they really stuck true to, you know, the Merry Melodies, Looney Tunes for all you kids out there who have no, like, Merry Melodies, what the fuck is that?
That sequence was supervised by Chuck Jones.
It looks just like
old school
Looney Tunes. That was really cool. I thought it was a neat little callback to the beginning when he's fencing, and they had that as the big climax. I don't really have again, I thought the Married with Children one would have been funnier if they just kept it with as Married with Children. But yeah, I don't remember all of them. Because they really go to town.
Yeah,
they go to town with it.
Mark, did you have one that stuck out for you, even if it was just like a joke's sake?
Well, for a joke's sake, the Different Strokes is obviously the
so good
the winner. I quite enjoyed. I was sitting here thinking about it, and I like the film noir thing just because how they didn't just have him be cool with the gun,
like going,
oh yeah, I know how this thing works, and just obviously. A person that would never have done that before would have no idea how to put, you know, the holster on or even know how to properly put a gun in his waistband and stuff. So that whole moment and the slight reveal that the one character we meet earlier ends up being the mob boss because he's so happy that his wife's dead.
Murray was
really good and fit that aesthetic perfectly. That joke, just because as people know listening to this, I love a good callback. And just bringing Murray back for that moment is what made it stand out to me as a whole segment. If we're taking the set pieces as they were, not just those little quick clips as they're going through the channels.
Sure. There was one little moment in that film noir that just made me smile is when after he punched out the three people or so, he hurts his hand and he like tries to hide the fact. I thought that was it was a simple little touch, but it was just kind of just. Like I said, that dorky charisma that John Ritter had.
Yeah, and something only he could pull off.
Yeah.
For that.
You know what I wish this movie didn't have? The kids.
They're a distraction.
I thought the movie would have been totally fine if it was a rekindling marriage story where Ritter is basically a loser, but he's married to a total boss, and he just uses television as his, you know, pretty much the same steps, the same beats that the movie has. But I guess, yeah, you need the kids because, well, I don't know why you need the daughter so much. She's just there to say like random 90s quips, right? Like you dingbat or you dweeb, dweebzoid.
So I've written these down because I made special mention of it. She calls him a dweebnik.
Dweebnik, there we go.
And a pusshead.
Yep. Okay. Yep.
And then she threatens him that he's pizza toppings.
That one I didn't quite understand.
I don't know either.
But okay. Well, I don't know why you need that.
No.
But yeah, because I thought it would have been cool if it was like they had to rely on each other to get out and not the kids.
I don't disagree.
It doesn't ruin it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of cutting back and forth between them and the TV and the kids. And the kids really don't play any part into the story until the very end. And it's for 10 seconds. So you could probably figure out a way to not have them play a role at it at all. And, you know, they were at their friend's house all weekend, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it has a much stronger message. I know he goes back for her at the end.
Yeah.
But I think it would have been cool if they just completed it on their own the first time, you know? They show that the wife is more than capable of handling herself right in the wrestling match.
Yep.
She single-handedly wins that for them. Yeah, I thought that would have been cooler. But again, was it enough for me to say, like, this movie sucks? No. I mean, again, it's a family comedy, essentially. Yeah. And I think the PG was kind of put there prior to PG meaning PG. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like All Dogs Go to Heaven having a G. And I don't know if that movie's a G just because it's a cartoon dog. There's some pretty scary visuals in All Dogs Go to Heaven.
Sure.
So it was one of those things like, yeah, you know, just slap a PG on it. It's 1992.
These kids are smoking these days.
Right. Mortal Kombat hasn't come out yet.
So stay tuned for 1992 is directed by Peter Hyams, who directed 2010, The Year We Make Contact, The Relic, Running Scared, and Time Cop.
Ooh. Yeah.
The stars, John Ritter, Pam Dauber, Jeffrey Jones, David Tom, Heather McComb, Bob Dishey, Joyce Gordon, Eugene Levy, Eric King, and Don Kalfa. Has an IMDb score of 6.2 and a Rotten Tomato score of 47%. Budget, $25 million. Box office, 10.7. Did not make its money back. You guys want to get into the plot?
Do it.
Okay. All
right. Dan, what do you got for us?
I'm going to give a quick shout out to our good friend, Tia, and her weekly podcast that she does with her friend Brittany called The Top 10 with Tia. It's a weekly podcast where she and her friend discuss top 10 lists. They have a lot of good lists on there. You could check her out at Geek Vibes Nation and also on Twitter at TC_Stark. And she's also the head writer for Geek Vibes Nation, with whom we are a proud member of. So you could go, while you're checking us out there, check her out as well.
Great. And we are going to take a quick break, and you guys are going to listen to some messages from friends of the podcast. We will be right back.
Hey, everyone, this is Steve.
And this is Adam.
And we're part of the Hop Nation USA podcast.
Pittsburgh's number 3 craft beer podcast.
Join us every Friday for new beer reviews.
We'll talk about the news, history, and homebrewing.
Plus, we'll sit down with the best brewers and industry personalities that'll have us.
So whether you're a casual drinker, a hazy boy hophead,
or even if you're a whale-hunting cellar hoarder,
just search Hop Nation USA on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcatcher and join the nation.
Oh, hi. Didn't see you there. It's me, George, from the Best Little Horror House in Philly, the show where we talk about the best horror movie ever made, according to our guest at least. We've talked about groundbreaking classics like Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Alien, but we've also got a lot of great ones coming up, including some very fun guests like Len Kabaczynski of Swamp Zombies and Red Letter Media fame, Caroline Williams, the star of Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, and Chase Williamson from John Dies at the End. So make sure you're subscribed to the Best Little Horror House in Philly, and I'll see you boils and ghouls over there.
And welcome back. Now it's time to get into the plot for Stay Tuned. We open on an elderly married couple as they watch Doogie Howser, MD. We know the man Murray is put upon by his wife as she complains that he didn't put enough butter on the popcorn. And the doorbell rings, and a man in a hat and overcoat tells Murray Seidenbaum, that he has a great offer for him. We then come back inside, and the wife goes to investigate where her husband went and finds popcorn bowl dropped on the ground, and then a light flashes, and she screams, and then we cut the credits.
I saw myself, like, I kept thinking, this is me in 30 years. There's not enough butter on the popcorn, Dan.
Well, hopefully it's not 30 years. Did you get your wife sucked into a television and stomped on by a Godzilla-like monster?
That kind of makes me think. If you're going to get sucked into TV now, it's probably better than it was in the 90s, no?
Probably. Right? You probably just, like, wind up on, like, a Chicago 911 show or something.
like Love Island or some shit like that, you know? Or I guess if you get voted off of Love Island, you probably like drown or die or something.
Right. The Bachelor.
Yeah. That'd be fun to be in The Bachelor, just get mercilessly heckled.
We then open on another house, and a teen boy named Daryl Nabel narrates in VO. He talks about how his family is pretty average, except for one fateful night. He also mentions that his dad loves to watch TV and watches more than your average person. His dad, Roy, played by John Ritter, watches an old swashbuckler movie and practices his fencing while he watches. His wife, Helen, Pam Dauber, is frustrated by Roy's constant obsession with television and tries to get him to come to bed, but to no avail. He's not fucking.
No, he's not. Now, is that the reason, like, later on, she makes mention of that, right? I'm going to find a man who would rather touch me than the remote.
Yeah.
So, yeah, John Ritter's, you know, he's pulling a Batman.
Yeah.
So you say John Ritter's a hero?
Yeah, that's what he's doing.
Helen's ready to go. She's ready.
She straddles him in all, right?
Yeah.
John Ritter, you fool.
Yeah. He's worried about double overtime.
Well, to be fair, the Supersonics weren't going to be around forever, so you got to get it while it's good.
That's true.
They're in double overtime.
Daryl then mentions that he thinks there's better things to do with TV, like making money from it. And then we see a scene where he manages to tap into the cable and broadcast a live stream of himself trying to sell videotapes of his sister kissing her boyfriend, which he taped in secret, which is super creepy.
It's extortion.
Yeah. This also awakens the ire of one of the neighbors, so I guess he sent that out to the whole neighborhood. Daryl then tells us his mom is a pretty big deal in the advertising department of some vitamin company, while Roy is a sad sack plumbing supplies salesman. We then see a few scenes of Roy being a sad sack plumbing supply salesman. Then he comes home and gets chased by the neighbor dog. Although, that house is really nice for a sad sack plumbing supply salesman.
Well, I think she's probably the breadwinner.
Sure, but you can't get that house anymore on one income.
Oh, especially in Seattle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's costing you a lot.
That's the most 90s of this movie.
Yeah. A 4-bedroom house. Man, that guy's really struggling.
Raising 2 kids.
Poor bastard.
Well, I wonder, you know, someone makes the joke that he can't sell plumbing supplies. Like, it's never going out of business. Toilets are never going out of business. And he still can't do it. Like, so he must be terrible and still making good money.
Yeah. Can't he get another job if he's that terrible? It does seem like a suck job.
Oh, yeah. Traveling, right? And doing that.
Like, doesn't seem like it's like the totally cliche 90s thing of what would be a terrible job. Salesman, like a traveling salesman, a door-to-door salesman.
Door-to-door sales. I can't think of anything worse. Sales in general is hard.
Yeah. And Roy does not have that bone in him.
No, he gives up too easily. That's his whole like shtick. If it's too hard, he doesn't want to be a part of it.
Yeah, I mean, nowadays we'd probably acknowledge that Roy is in a deep, depressive episode.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, everyone would be clamoring for like, this man needs help, and not just like, oh, look how funny he is.
Yeah. At night, Daryl and his sister head off to stay at friend's house. Apparently, it was a plan the kids devised so that their parents could spend some time together and fix their marriage. Roy, however, is consumed by a basketball game on television. So while his wife tries to convince him to go away for the weekend, or at the very least, open up to her about the current funk that he's in, he can't stop looking at the television. So she throws one of his old fencing trophies through it, just like in the Office episode, the dinner party.
Is it a fencing trophy in that episode, too?
It's a Dundee.
Oh, it's a Dundee.
Forgot about that. That's a great episode, too.
Yeah, I remembered the trophy. I was like, was that like a veiled Stay Tuned reference? Did he do a fencing trophy?
They just completely ripped off Stay Tuned for that episode. Later in the night, we see you in the office. Later in the night, the man in the hat and coat shows up at Roy's house, offering him a great deal. Comes in and talks to him about a brand new television satellite system with a fancy remote. It's got 666 channels and 900 lines of resolution. Roy can't commit to it because he can't afford it, basically, not without talking to his wife. But then the salesman tells him that there's a free trial. So they're up and at him. They set it up with an enormous dish in the backyard immediately and then leave. The salesman drives off laughing like a maniac. How I assume a timeshare salesman laughs when you leave. And then drives down into a hole into the earth that opens up for him. Which is normal. Then Helen comes home. I'm not sure where she was coming from at this point. And she gets pissed at the new TV system, so goes upstairs to pack. She's ready to move out. And then we get our first parody, Three Men and Rosemary's Baby. And then sadistic hidden videos, which was a pretty funny sketch.
That was so... That was kind of, like, depressing when I saw it. Because that's what, like, life turned out to be with TV. It was just like, let's prank as many people as we can and... Like, they did it in radio. It took over all sorts of media.
It's just man, a great prank.
Yeah, your husband died. Yeah, that's a great prank.
look at that. Do you see that thing across the street?
And then, the woman, I guess, is in on the joke when she realizes, like, oh, this is a popular TV series. And she's all laughing about it. I would have been furious.
I wonder how many people without the Candid Cameron reference or Candid Cameron, Candid Camera reference.
It's not Candace Cameron.
Cameron.
I thought you were talking about the other Cameron.
Kirk Cameron,
yeah.
God, I was trying to say Candid Camera reference that we probably have would even get that joke.
Yeah. I mean, I guess punked. I guess they could kind of punked and all their and stupid YouTubers.
I mean, I think that's what it's devolved into, really.
Yeah.
TikTok.
So then the reception starts to crap out. So Roy goes into the back to deal with the dish, and Helen comes out to find him fiddling with it. So she starts hitting with the rake and then tells Roy that she's leaving him. And the satellite wakes up and sucks them both into it. And they wind up on a game show called You Can't Win. It's a standard game show with questions and answers. And the game reveals that one time Roy lied about car trouble so he could watch the World Series while Helen had a romantic dinner planned. Is Roy gay, maybe?
I don't think so. I think he's just...
He just does not want to fuck Helen.
Well, listen. Now, I don't want you guys to point fingers at me here, but every... What's the way of putting it? Even Jay-Z cheated on Beyonce. You know what I'm saying? Just because... Like, yeah, Helen, you know, she's a smoke show here. Doesn't mean he's not tired of her, you know? It happens.
I know what you're saying. I think the statement is like, you show me a beautiful woman and I'll show you a guy that's tired of fucking her.
Exactly, yeah.
But come on, Roy, you are clutching at straws of anything that resembles a normal, healthy life in general. And your wife, and if the only thing you could hang your hat on is that I get to have consistent sex with a woman that's way ahead of my league. You got to grab that rabbit and kill it so it doesn't leave you.
Yeah. To most people, I think you're right. Right. It seems like it makes the most sense. Right. I mean, he's a loser.
Yeah.
And he's got a wife who he could basically, I bet he could be a stay at home dad.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and maybe that's
Jay-Z is going to find someone to fuck him. Right.
Regardless.
Ain't nobody fucking Roy. No. Besides Mrs. Roy.
Yeah, that's 100% true. Yeah, Roy does. I'm assuming Roy doesn't have the pull that a world famous rap artist has.
Yeah, Roy's got to eat pussy.
Yeah, that would have been great if that's what they like broke down later in the movie. It was just like, man, I miss the way like you were a go getter and the way you just went to town on me. Oh shit, really earning that PG rating.
Yeah.
We then cut to the control room of the television company as Crowley, Eugene Levy, brings a new hire, Pierce, up to speed. We then see the salesman sitting down at a corporate desk in a suit. His name is Spike. He seems to be the director of whatever you would call television. On the monitors, he directs the Seidenbaums in a Godzilla ripoff where Mrs. Seidenbaum gets crushed and Murray Seidenbaum runs away. Everyone treats Spike like a genius, but Pierce, who is a recent film school grad, says the whole execution lacks subtext. Spike tells him that there's no room for subtext because they're ultimately playing to an audience of one, the devil, and he only cares about the misery of others. We also got the rundown for the whole operation. Heaven and Hell have come to an agreement, and Hell has 24 hours to kill the people they manage to get in. If they do, their souls go to Hell. If the person survives, they go back to Earth.
Now, I'm curious. Isn't the whole... It wouldn't matter who Spike is catering to. It's Hell, right?
He says that they're specifically catering to the devil because he just loves to watch people in misery.
Now, but who else, you're in Hell. What other programming should there be in Hell? Right? It should be pain and misery and torture and...
Right, but the whole operation is to have, like, a gauntlet of sorts. They don't own those souls outright until they die.
Gotcha. Oh, that makes more sense then.
Yeah.
So it's because he does mention that it's only happened once where the souls have escaped.
Yep.
Okay. So, yeah, you're not really giving them their fair shake.
Yeah. We then come back to You Can't Win and the final question, which is a trick question insinuating that one of them is cheating on the other. But Helen realizes what the trick question is, and she gets the right answer. I won't bore you with the details. Back in the control room, Pierce asks about the contest and how long people usually last. Spike says no one ever survived, so it doesn't matter. And then Crowley corrects him, saying one guy did, and then insinuates that it was Spike's fault. So Spike gets mad at this and sends Crowley on some quote-unquote field work, as he calls it, and zaps Crowley with a remote control and sends him into one of the televisions. Meanwhile, the Nables get pushed through a door with TV static behind it and wind up on a wrestling show with ring announcer Captain Lou Albano, and they have to fight the Gorgons, including Mr. Gorgon, played by One Man Gang from WCW. While they bicker about whether or not Roy is threatened by Helen's success, the match starts, and Roy gets absolutely demolished by the Gorgons. Eventually, Roy gets tossed out of the ring, and then Mrs. Gorgon turns her sights on Helen. Gorgon tosses her around and winds up pulling out some of Helen's hair, so Helen grabs a mic stand from ringside and knocks both of the Gorgons out with it, and they win the fight. Apparently, this is a no-holds-barred match.
I did chuckle when they met at the center ring, and the referee's like, you do whatever you want to each other, maul each other, kill each other, I don't care. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Pam Dauber was 5 months pregnant during the filming of this movie, so they must have very creatively used the stunt double on the scene.
Nice. Good for her.
They then fall into a hole that opens up in the ring and move on to the next channel. Meanwhile, the kids come home and find the house empty, but they see the new satellite dish and TV. The arrow flicks through the channels, and we see a few more parodies. Autopsies of the Rich and Famous, Northern Overexposure, and Max Hell commercial, which is probably the joke that holds up the least.
Yeah.
What is the joke?
So there's a Maxwell commercial for like stereos and stuff. And it's the guy sitting in the lounge chair in front of the stereo.
Oh, yes.
And then they just have his head basically blow off on this one.
They kind of did that with The Simpsons, right? With the movies.
The Simpsons did have a similar joke to it, yeah.
That was the surround sound, right?
There's that and the THX sound. It's a little bit different.
Yeah. You're not listening or something like that? Or
something like, yeah.
Yeah.
Roy and Helen find themselves in Northern Overexposure and in some version of Alaska in the wilderness. They come across Crowley, who is digging through the snow, trying to dig his way into a different channel. Then a pack of wolves show up and chase all three of them into a nearby cabin. Back at home, Daryl finds a note on the fridge that says the parents had gone out for a while and they'll call to explain tomorrow. So Diane thinks it's the perfect opportunity to throw a party and tells Daryl to beat it. And Daryl goes outside and the satellite turns on and almost sucks him in, but it sucks up to his bike and then turns off. Diane goes outside to see what the hell he's up to, and she doesn't believe him when he tells her what happened. Back at the cabin, Crowley tells the Nables the whole deal and mentions they need to survive the next 15 hours. Then he accidentally breaks off one of his fingers due to the cold. That's a good running joke, him constantly losing appendages throughout the movie.
I kind of thought, I liked how they used Eugene Levy in this. I thought they could have used him a little more. Because he shows up a little bit too sporadically.
Yeah, so he shows up here and then he doesn't show up again until the French Revolution.
Yeah.
They could have used another one. Yeah.
I think it could have been like, almost like the Divine Comedy, right? Where it's like Dante and the Angel, where Eugene Levy kind of plays. It's I tried to sound smart one time, and I forget who the angel is that leads Dante through the seven layers of hell.
Yeah,
I think it's Michelangelo. We'll say Michelangelo. It's not Michelangelo, but it would have been cool if like Levy kind of leads them through a little bit. Not always, but he shows up more often.
Sure. At the house, Diane's friends come over and they all rush upstairs while Daryl investigates the television. And we get more parodies. 30-something to Life and a commercial for a child muzzle called The Silencers of the Lambs.
That was pretty dark.
30-something to Life was a pretty good one. And then Meet the Mansons, a Leave It to Beaver type show with a young Chuck Manson. And Daryl's bike shows up on that show. So Daryl goes to tell his sister. He thinks their parents are in the TV, but she blows him off. And back at the cabin, the wolves have gone quiet, so Crowley decides it's safe enough to leave and jump through the conduit that he had uncovered. He opens the door and there's no sign of the wolves, but as he steps out, one jumps from the roof and attacks him, and then the others come from somewhere and start to maul him. Roy closes the door, and in the chaos, they knock over an oil lamp and the cabin catches fire. So the Nables push against the wall, causing the cabin, which was really more of an ice fishing shed, to move. And they're able to push the shed over the conduit hole and jump through as the wolves enter the cabin.
I think this is the first time, and maybe it's just ignorance on my part, that I realized that those sheds would be very easy to move. Or I don't know. Or maybe they're not, and that's part of the joke. I don't know.
I don't think it's particularly a joke. I think if you have enough force, you probably should be able to push them. If they're on ice specifically, yeah. Why wouldn't you be able? They're not nailed down or anything like that.
Yeah, maybe I thought they were nailed down. I don't know. It was just when they did, I was like, I just went, huh, okay.
Yeah.
I don't even want to pretend to know the first thing about ice fishing. What goes into it?
We'll have to ask Mythbusters.
Right. it never seemed particularly enjoyable. Right, sitting in a shed on a lake of ice.
Yeah, I mean, fishing itself seems to be, like, minimally enjoyable.
I've never gotten really any enjoyment out of it. I've gone on, like, those party boats, and I fucking hated life being out there.
So I've been on a party boat, and I've been fishing. Fishing is a lot more fun than a party boat.
I hated party. And I've gone multiple times, and each time I went, like, why am I doing this?
I've gone hungover. That was not fun.
Were we together on that one?
No.
Okay. No. I can't recall, but I've gone on multiple, and yeah, just I can't imagine being hungover on one of those. God.
Nope.
That sounds like hell.
That's pretty close. It's my version of one of these channels.
Is Anthony on the Fishing Network?
Yeah.
Just constantly throwing up over the side. We're hunting bluefish.
They probably attract fish, right?
You're chumming?
So they jump through the hole and they wind up as two mice in a Tom and Jerry type cartoon. Production of this animation sequence supervised by Chuck Jones himself. And as a mouse, as mice, they have to evade a robotic cat. Meanwhile, Daryl watches the cartoon and recognizes both of his parents in cartoon form. I do love the part where she takes out her wallet to show the pictures of the kids, and the kids are mice, too.
I was not expecting that. Good.
So he drags Diane down to look at the cartoon, but she laughs him off and goes back upstairs. The robot cat does a great job of destroying the house as it tries to kill the Nables. They manage to electrocute the cat by dropping a hairdryer in the tub, but because it's a cat, it has 9 lives, so it boots back up like the Terminator. They seek refuge in a dollhouse where Roy finds his wife more attractive as a cartoon mouse than he ever does in the real world. Eventually, the cat finds them and they try to escape by driving a toy car. They drive with the cat in pursuit and discover the conduit portal in a mouse hole.
This movie predicted the Lola Bunny predicament that we find ourselves in.
Yeah, exactly.
You're a hot mouse. Like, oh, I can't jerk off to an anamorphic bunny. Make her sexy. Roar.
Yeah, this is the first time he's ever looking at it like, oh, I'm ready to go now.
Yeah, he was really, he was digging her. Yeah. We find out he has a mouse fetish.
That's the problem in their relationship. She won't dress up like a mouse.
She won't go furry. You won't give in to my kink. God damn it. You knew when you married me.
So Helen gets through the conduit, but Roy loses control of the car and the cat blocks the door before he could get in. So then Roy uses cartoon logic and sends a letter to the Acme company. And seconds later, the Acme company drops off a robot dog and the dog destroys the house chasing the cat. And Roy manages to get through the conduit after that. So Daryl tries to find his parents on the next channel. And we are treated to what might be the best parody of the movie, Different Strokes. Which is just two old men on a couch having two strokes.
But they're having different strokes.
Different strokes. One loses his sight and one can't feel his arms or something. Like
it was so dark.
Oh man, bravo whoever wrote that one.
That I think the funniest part of that for me was watching the paramedics come in. And I was just like, holy shit, did they just die?
Oh, it's so dark, but it's fucking hilarious.
You really got
dark for a PG movie.
Yeah. That's very true. I feel like a lot of the gags were a little dark, right? Because Three Men and Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah.
That's one of that's a pretty big horror movie.
The Exorcises.
The head turning.
Yeah.
There were so many. And again, kudos to them for really exploring the room.
Yeah.
But holy shit, there was a lot.
Yeah. And then My Three Sons of Bitches, which is just the title card.
Yeah, there's a lot of title cards. You don't see a whole, not every single one has an actual show.
Yeah. And then he finds his parents on Saturday Night Dead in Dwayne's Underworld sketch. Roy is tied to a chair with a Sphincter Boy shirt on, and Dwayne and Garf terrorize him by slamming cameras in his face during extreme close-ups. Eventually, they try to get him with the hot poker in the eye cam, but he kicks it and winds up undoing the ropes, and he runs up the stairs to the conduit. He then winds up in a film noir detective movie, as does Helen. And back at the control room, Spike is feeling the pressure as the Nables only need to survive 6 more hours. And Pierce, whose first day on the job, gives him shit for it, too. Pierce is a little bit big in his britches for the first day on the job.
Well, he's a film school student.
Right.
That's true. We're assholes.
He definitely comes in guns blazing, I'll say. And I'm sure... Anthony, you've seen your fair share, and I know I've seen my fair share of guys who come in thinking that they could reinvent the wheel, you know?
Sure.
And this guy definitely exudes that energy.
Yeah. Back at the house, Daryl goes outside and sees Diane and her friends practicing their cheer routine, despite the fact that he told his sister to stay away from the backyard. As the satellite starts to wake up again, he goes to the house and sprays all the girls with a hose and runs back into the house as the girls chase after him. After the girls leave, Daryl shows Diane the film noir, and she recognizes her mom and starts to believe Daryl, finally. In the film noir, Helen gets taken hostage and brought to the Seidenbaum nightclub, where Murray Seidenbaum is hanging out, and he says he never wants to leave. He also brought with him his remote, somehow. Some other gangsters show up to the club and try to move in on Seidenbaum's turf and start shooting up the place.
I love with the reference or whatever they went for here with that gun never running out of ammunition from the guy that pulls out the two Tommy guns.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You know, just like, oh, of course, in this movie, no one ever reloads.
Except Roy's only got one shot.
Yeah.
He makes it count.
Yeah. Everyone takes cover. Murray gets shot, but gives the Nables the remote, and they get out of the movie. Meanwhile, Daryl gets an idea in order to contact his parents by creating a transmitter from Diane's stereo, as she watches the TV to make sure that they don't lose her parents. Diane finds them in a mini-series about the French Revolution called Off With His Head. Helen and Roy are hiding in the streets of Paris as Roy is a marquis trying to avoid execution. Roy, meanwhile, is in drag, and the remote is destroyed when they switch channels. And then Crowley shows up with fewer appendages than we last saw him, thanks to the wolves, but he's still in good spirits. He ushers them into a tavern and tells them to lay low until he finds a conduit portal, and he says they just gotta survive the next 2 hours. As they hide out, Roy makes a promise to Helen that he's going to be different if they survive this. He's going to be the guy that she married, basically. So Daryl puts the finishing touches on the transmitter. Meanwhile, two French soldiers come into the tavern and are attracted to both Helen and Roy, Roy being in drag, and sits themselves down and order more wine. As they're sitting there, the two guards get a little handsy, so the Nables go to leave, but one of the guards accidentally pulls Roy's wig off. And they arrest him and send him to the guillotine. They bring him to the gallows as he pleads for his innocence. Meanwhile, Daryl is hooking up the machine, and it's almost ready. He has a run-in with the neighbor dog in the process. As the guillotine goes up, Daryl beams his transmission into the channel, and everyone mistakes his voice for the voice of God. So Helen takes the initiative and says it is God, and asks him to tell them to release the marquee. And then Daryl complies and tells them to release him. And then the transmitter breaks, and he can't transmit anything anymore.
This was one problem I did have. A child has the earthly technology to match the technology of hell. How does that work out?
Well, it was late 80s, early 90s. You know.
So stuff at your local Radio Shack, is that what hell's working with?
So if I want to get technical, what he does is he just creates a transmission, which he beams directly into the satellite, and the satellite, like, it sucks up the bike and his parents, also sucks up the transmission.
So it's just whatever transmission he's putting out. Anyone could have done it.
Yep. basically.
Interesting.
He's just transmitting it into the satellite dish, with the satellite dish just taking as it does everything else.
My reference was more towards the equipment he had. It's just that time frame where every nerdy kid had this whole computer motherboard chip set up in his room and could rip out the guts of a stereo and use those pieces to build his transmission machine.
Yeah. But we've already seen him be able to do it in the beginning with trying to sell his sister's
sex tape. Oh, they set it up in this movie. It just seems like trope back then.
Right? He's marketing his underage sister's sex tape, more or less.
If I'm the devil, or if I run the Hell Network, I'm getting him.
Right?
This kid's, he's a smart kid.
And he's got a questionable moral compass.
He's already checked off that he's willing to pretty much like do whatever it takes to get ahead, you know. And yeah, it's, you know, he's going to throw his family under the bus. You know, you got yourself a winner.
Yep. Roy is released and Crowley celebrates as they've quote unquote beaten Spike. Back at the control room, the clock expires and Nables have officially reached redemption status. So Pierce gloats to Spike, so Spike starts to strangle him against the boardroom table, but then an exec comes in and tells Spike that they found a loophole. The contract was only for one person, so he technically only has to send Roy back. So Spike sends Roy back, leaving Helen in the French Revolution, and Roy gets spit back out onto the lawn. Spike's plan is to goad Roy back into the TV, and he's going to personally see to it that both of them die. So Spike beams himself into the French Revolution miniseries and absconds with Helen into a Western, with her tied to the train tracks with a wagon full of dynamite behind her. Roy goes back into the TV and comes into the Western in the role of the man with no name. Spike shows up as the Black Hat and they have a duel, but Roy can't get his gun out of his belt and gets shot. But the shot hits his remote that was in his pocket, and he surprises Spike with the punch. They wrestle over the remote until Roy manages to change the channel and winds up in Star Trek in the Next Generation as Picard. And Spike is there as the villain of the episode, saying that their remotes are linked, so wherever Roy goes, Spike will go. Roy manages to get the remote back and changes the channel to a crash test with Roy as one of the dummies. And just before it crashes, he beams out to a hockey game versus a whole team of Spikes. Then he beams out again to driving over Mrs. Daisy.
That was pretty good. Yeah. Going back and forth.
As he watches a Jessica Tandy stand-in get demolished by a car driven by Spike. And then a Spike runs her over and back over and over again until he goes for Roy. And then he beams out to Three's Company, which is the most rewarding joke in movie history. And he immediately beams back out and winds up in a Musketeer-ish film where Spike challenges him to a sword fight. But Roy doesn't have a sword and his remote is destroyed. So as Spike is going in for the kill shot, Daryl beams out one of Roy's fencing swords into the dish, and his dad gets it. So Spike and Roy have a sword fight for a while, both of them doing pretty well, until eventually Spike's remote falls out of his sleeve, so they both struggle over it until they beam themselves into a Salt and Peppa video. Salt and Peppa perform as Roy and Spike try to retrieve the remote, which is being passed around from backup dancer to backup dancer. This scene goes on for a little bit too long.
Yeah. It's a full song.
It's a full song. Eventually, Salt and Pepper hand deliver the remote to Roy, who uses it to sap Spike away.
Question.
Yep.
Are Salt and Pepper in hell?
It seems to be.
Right. But why? Why do they need to go to hell?
I don't know. Maybe hell doesn't have a music scene, so they also just play music from Earth.
Or are they trying to say they sold their souls to the devil?
Or maybe it's a race thing. Maybe this movie's secret racist.
Oh, God. There's so many.
We found it.
Who knows? It could be anything. We have to get Salt and Pepper on the podcast, see what they say.
Then Roy zaps himself back to Helen as the train is bearing down on her. Control room turns off the ability for the Nables to change the channel, but they are able to turn it off and are zapped out of the TV just in time. As they get spit back out of the satellite dish, the family reunites, and the neighbor's dog comes into the yard, barking and snarling. But the satellite pulls the dog in and then self-destructs. The dog is brought to the Musketeer movie, where Spike is now hiding in a chandelier as the dog barks at him. And Crowley appears in a suit of armor and cuts the rope of the chandelier, sending it crashing to the ground with Spike on it. And then Pierce looks on, supposedly taking Spike's job. Then we cut to some time later. All this is behind them as Roy is now open to fencing academy, and Daryl in voiceover mentions that Roy only watches the show 60 minutes. He doesn't watch TV anymore.
Oh, God. That made me, like, I shuddered when he said he only watches 60 minutes. Ugh.
And then freeze frame ending as Roy practices his fencing as the kids leave. And then credits roll as we get some previews of some parodies I guess they didn't have time for, including the David Dukes of Hazzard, which is a fantastic way to end this movie. Yeah.
That made me chuckle. That was a really good one.
And that is the end of Stay Tuned. Creative movie, pretty charming. It's a mile a minute in terms of the jokes that they throw at you in terms of the previews and the parodies. Some of them land, some of them don't, but I had a fun time with this, revisiting this one.
Yeah, for sure. It was definitely, as we said, it was very 90s. It had the 90s aesthetic. The television shows definitely mirrored the pop culture landscape at the time.
Yeah.
And again, I loved how they really explored being in a TV. It's not just a couple channels anymore. There were so many channels that they could play with, and they paid homage to. And again, the Three's Company one really does pay off. I'm glad they did it. Mm-hmm. And even though it's the most obvious joke, it didn't need to be done, right? Yeah. They could have easily have just glossed over it. You know John Ritter, right? You know that he's in that. But they did it, and then they didn't harp on it. It was just a quick in and out.
Yeah, it's like maybe 4 seconds.
Yeah, it's great. It's definitely a good add-in. We've mentioned how great John Ritter was. He's very lovable. I don't think he's ever been in a role where he doesn't have that lovable aura, like that lovable loser. He was great in this. I wish they could have used a little bit more Eugene Levy. I thought that would have been pretty cool. And we didn't really mention Jeffrey Jones in this,
right?
As he plays Spike, and obviously questionable past
personal life.
personal life. But as in the movies that he's in, I've always enjoyed him.
Yeah.
He's very funny in this. He's a very good antagonist.
Yeah.
I thought this movie, although it's not a classic.
No.
But I could definitely see it having cult status.
Sure. Yeah, I don't know what it would have done differently, but this feels like it could have. So I've read that Tim Burton was offered to direct this, but he turned it down to do Batman Returns. But I could see like a Joe Dante, you know, kind of bringing that kind of the Burbs kind of darkness to this.
Yeah, Gremlins, that would have been cool.
Stuff like that. I mean, I think Peter Hyams, he also was the director of photography on this too. I don't think that this movie is lacking because of the director, but I think there is a sense of style that a Joe Dante has that I think he could have brought something to it. And obviously Tim Burton's got his own style. I don't know if he would have been right for this, to be honest with you. I don't think this movie is better with the Tim Burton flair to it.
Sure. Yeah, I do think it does lack an aesthetic in terms of just... Everything is just very kind of plain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's not a whole lot that sticks out. Even when they're in the television, not a whole lot sticks out. But yeah, again, I don't think it really takes away from the movie that much.
No, I enjoyed myself. I'm glad this movie held up.
Yeah.
It was, you know, I don't regret watching it, which is probably the bar for the movies that are chosen for this podcast. It was better than I was anticipating, and I should have known that with John Ritter being the star of it. But yeah, it was, I think there were probably a few references I said earlier that probably would have gotten more, you know, if I watched it back when it came out in 92. But the ones they did make were fantastic, and I will probably continue thinking about Different Strokes for a long time because that was so good. And it took me a while to get what was going on until the title card popped up. And then it was one of those moments where I couldn't believe they were doing that in a PG movie. But yeah, I think it's, you know, entirely worth a watch if you're thinking about it. Just don't go in with expectations that it's any kind of like world-beating movie. You know, it's just fine. It's charming. It's short. It doesn't drag too much. So yeah, I enjoyed it.
Great. Yeah. I am a sucker for these 90s high concept family movies. And this one's a good one. And I think that's all we got to say about this movie. You guys want to plug your shit?
Real quick.
Yeah, sure.
The Three's Company, were the actresses the actual actresses?
They were not. Right? Okay. No, they never even you never even see them in full. They're blurred with a short depth of field.
I thought so, but I don't know Three's Company all that well enough.
Yeah, it was not Suzanne Somers.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, yeah, that's it for me. I'll plug my shit. At @DeAquino122 is my personal Twitter, and you could also follow our Real Play D&D podcast on Twitter and Instagram @StrangerDamies. We offer updates on when we're streaming, new episodes, just random stuff as well. We do our best, but yeah, follow us on there and come chat with us.
So we have Stranger Damies, our D&D podcast, airs every other Wednesday. Be sure to check that out on anywhere you get your podcast. We have a gaming podcast, the Game Vault Pod, airs every other Monday. That's on Instagram and Twitter @GameVaultPod. And then we stream at twitch.tv/GameVaultPod, which is also where our live sessions of Stranger Damies airs. So be sure to check that out. We stream on Wednesdays, Thursdays, every other Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. Yeah, come over, do like, share, subscribe, all that good stuff. And looking forward to, some good D&D coming up. I think you guys are getting to a good part of the current arc you're in.
Okay, great. And we are They Call This a Movie. You can find us on Spreaker and wherever you get your podcast just by searching They Call This Movie. We are themaindamon.com. That's our main website. You can find us at themaindamon.com or on all socials just by searching The Main Damies. That's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Just search The Main Damie and we'll pop right up. We're also proud member of Geek Vibes Nation. You can find them at gvnation.com and on all socials and all podcast streaming apps just by searching Geek Vibes Nation. Tons of great shows. If you're into geek stuff, there's surely a show for you. We're also on TikTok. You can find They Call This Movie on TikTok. Just search They Call This Movie on your TikTok app and we will be there. Give us a follow and like our videos on there so we could get a following there. If you have any questions or comments, you want to suggest a movie to us, you can hit us up at themainamy@gmail.com. It's our email account there. And that's about all the ways you could get a hold of us. This has been Stay Tuned from 1992, directed by Peter Hyams, who was a repeater on this podcast. So, for Dan Aquino and Mark Myers, this is Anthony DeVecchio telling Peter Hyams, well, you certainly made a movie, didn't you?